On today's episode of Born to Know, I dive into the fascinating world of German New Medicine, GNM. We have a truly special guest, Dr. Melissa Sell, a leading pioneer in the field of GNM. Her groundbreaking work has helped countless individuals worldwide understand the profound impact emotional and traumatic conflicts can have on the body, producing physical symptoms, chronic disease, and supposedly incurable illnesses. Have you ever been told you just have to live with this the rest of your life and manage it with a pill? If you've ever wondered why certain health conditions seem to have no clear cause, like the uncle who never smoked a day in his life or worked in a coal mine but ends up with stage 3 lung cancer one day, or why seemingly unrelated events in your life might show up repeatedly as a physical symptom, spoiler alert, it's not because of flu season, Dr. Sell is here to shed light on how our unresolved emotional conflicts are often at the root of these issues. With her expertise in German New Medicine, she explains how our bodies are not just passive vessels, they are actively responding to emotional stresses and traumas, and are always in motion to resolve these issues in the body. Are you ready to understand how cancer cells are actually helpers and the body's attempt to resolve a bigger, deep-rooted issue? For the parents out there who dealt with preeclampsia, jaundice, or the seemingly impossible choice of declining vitamin K or the antibiotics in labor, for the man or woman who has ever dealt with illness or supported a family member through their physical health challenges, this is a must-listen. This is a fresh perspective on how we can break free from the dependency on pharmaceuticals, understand the deeper causes of illness, and ultimately take charge of our health in a less helpless and codependent way. So grab a seat, relax, and prepare to unlock new ways of seeing your body, wellness, and healing. Hey, Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today on Born to Know. It is such a pleasure to be here with you.
Hi, Ayla. I'm so happy to be here. So excited to chat.
I was introduced to German New Medicine about 5 years ago, right before the events of 2020 started happening. There was just kind of like this whisper of it. And then it blew open for me, of course, during 2020. I came across your work, some of the video content you'd created. And then, of course, there was this big question circulating all over the world, or at least my world, about, you know, terrain theory versus germ theory, and really just breaking open concepts as to how we have been trained from birth, generation after generation, recent generations, to view health, to view disease, you know, how we experience that, because the way we view disease really shapes the way we live and how we view the world. Like, you know, so I remember a lot was just breaking open for me, and it influenced my work with women in the birth world and understanding birth interventions differently and understanding the nature of pregnancy in a new way. And anyway, so it was such a journey that I started to go on. And I mean, to this day, it's been a few years now, and I'm still at the surface of, you know, this world of German New Medicine. However, the principles I have applied, what I have researched, has always proven itself to be effective. I've always had what I would say is like a moment of becoming a believer, you know, in a sense that I've never been disappointed by it or the framework, and neither have the people I've shared it with. So I'm really excited for this conversation and to give people the opportunity to, you know, reflect on a new possibility for themselves if they're new to this. So could you share how you stepped into this work?
Definitely. So it was I had been in my work. So my degree is in chiropractic, and I worked in the world of just all things holistic living, nutrition and exercise and detox and spinal alignment. I just, you know, loved everything about like changing your lifestyle, change your lifestyle, eat healthy, clean up the bad stuff. And that this is going to, you know, prevent disease. And so that was my world for many years and my platform and what I taught. And in my personal life, my partner and I, we kind of moved more in the direction of, you know, looking at mindset, right? Of things going on that aren't visible from the outside. And so we had been like the trajectory of our work was already shifting more towards the inner world, you know, and helping people to understand that your perception of reality, it makes a humongous difference in what's going on for you in every area of your life, in your finances, in your health. It's the unseen things, right? It's the inner workings of your mind. So we had already been going in that direction. And I was still doing nutrition and health coaching and things like that. And I came across a podcast about magnesium supplementation because I was giving a workshop on magnesium supplementation. And I heard Dr. Carolyn Dean, she just very briefly, the person interviewing her asked her about cancer. And she just very briefly dropped the words German New Medicine and moved on with the interview. And I was like, what is this? You know, and by that point, I'd already been, you know, really, I mean, 10 years at least in the holistic health world. And I had gone to chiropractic school. And I was like, you know, I really thought that I knew a lot about all things alternative health. And then I looked up German New Medicine and my mind was completely blown because here was a framework, here was an understanding, here was a doctor and his experience of cancer and his discovery that there are specific biological conflicts, these events that catch you off guard, that are highly emotional and isolating, and that the body, and this is something I already believed, you know, in the world of chiropractic, I believe that the body does the right thing, that the body is intelligent. It is wiser than the educated mind. It is wiser than, you know, the mind that has been coming up with theories for about 5,000 years, right? About health and what's been, you know, what goes on in the body, right? We've been coming up with all sorts of, oh, is it this or is it that? We've been exploring these things, but the body is ancient and wise, and the body builds new bodies. The body heals itself. The body can rebuild itself. And that's like the chiropractic philosophy that I was really into is all about how smart the body is and how, you know, comparatively stupid the human mind can be when looking at, you know, what the body does. And so when I read Dr. Hammer's story and I saw, you know, his map, that's the map, the five biological laws and the different germ layers, I was like, this makes more sense than what I previously was believing about health and sickness. And so that's really, you know, I am committed to what makes the most sense to me. And, you know, I used to be more kind of dogmatic and just committed to, you know, my previous beliefs for the sake of being committed to my previous beliefs. But now, you know, I have through my journey, it's like, oh no, I'm committed to what makes the most sense. And to me, the map of the five biological laws and the laws of the body adapting in response to a conflicting experience, that just makes sense to me. It's logical that the body would grow extra salivary gland tissue if there was a concern about being able to swallow something, right? That makes sense. It's logical that the body would do that. It's logical that the body would widen the bronchial airway if there was a threat in the territory. It's like, yeah, that's really logical. It's logical that Dr. Hammer developed testicular cancer after his son was shot and killed. You know, so his son died and the biology says, oh, my offspring is gone. And so what does it do? It enhances and reinforces the testicular tissue. That to me is profound and logical. And so the previous ideas I had that bad nutrition or toxins cause tumors or cause disease, it made less sense. At the time when I was believing it, it made the most sense to me. It was the, you know, the model framework that made the most sense. But now this one makes the most sense to me currently. And like your experience, I have not seen it be incorrect. Dr. Hammer, he was connected to something, right? He made these, he saw something. He saw these patterns in nature. He, you know, that's what a genius recognizes patterns. He saw the pattern, the psyche brain organ. He looked at the brain scans. He saw that every time there was a cancer, there was always the person had a specific type of emotional shock, and there is always a circle in the brain at a specific location every single time. You know, that's legit. It is, and it's a consistent system. And that's what's so cool about this.
An actual circle.
Yeah, it's an impact. It's the DHS. You look at a CT brain scan and there are impacts. It looks like, you know, when you throw a pebble into a pond, there's like this ring, you know, this ripple that comes out from, so that's the area. And so there's correlations. The brain regions are the same for everyone. We all have the same brain map. And depending on your specific life circumstances, you know, someone can read your brain scan. Hopefully there'll be a study course for us all to learn how to read brain scans. But right now it's a few people learn from Dr. Hammer how to read the brain scan and can see, they can look at your brain and tell you things that you're like, oh my, reveal to you basically the map, your fingerprint of your life experiences and where you have, you know, a mole on your left shoulder and you have a bleeding ulcer here and you have, you know, and you're retaining water and all of these things just by looking at the brain scan.
I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, these experiences we have as children, right, where we're taught from birth to view the external world as the enemy, right? Kind of you referenced that in a sense. You didn't use the word enemy, but it's like, what things can I do? Can I add to my body? What can I engage with in my environment to protect myself from the same environment, right? And so, you know, children, it's like, don't touch the doorknob and then touch your mouth. Don't, you know, sneeze without covering your nose because, you know, the germs will be airborne and then they will come. There's like this, you know, boogeyman, right? That's kind of out there at any moment, you know, waiting to attack. So there's this kind of like victim pursuer dynamic that's happening. And, you know, I've heard people talk about it like that, like, oh, it's out to get me, or, you know, I can't walk outside with wet hair because the temperature itself, the climate itself is out to get me. So there's almost this like, this interesting relationship that children from an early age, if not even in the womb, begin to cultivate with their environment. And then, you know, there's the unlearning process, right, that I that I personally went through of understanding that, like, I could do all the things, right? I could do, like, the biohacking. I could do all the things. And if my internal world was not given more attention, more, you know, credence, then it didn't matter if I bought all the things or did all the things or, you know, put the certain paint in the house or put the certain filters in the house, right? Not that those things don't matter, right? But they're not the primary. They're still feeding into the idea that we're under attack from the outside. And so what would you say? Because I'm sure you've seen many cases with your patients where, you know, there's a heavy focus on how to rearrange the environment in order to protect oneself. What are some moments where people have had breakthroughs, you know, when they've been really heavy in the external curation and then make that transition into seeing like, oh, it's, you know, my internal world is where I should be focusing?
Well, I think so many people have gone through that. And I think it's a logical progression that you go from believing in germs, right? You believe, okay, it's the germs or bad genes that cause disease. And so we have to, you know, use antibiotics, we have to use antiseptic, we have to use Lysol, we have to clean all the bacteria off of everything. We have to, you know, do our best to outwit the germs, right, with injections. And so we try this whole thing, we think it's the germs. And then you kind of come into this, you know, that doesn't really make sense. And it seems like there's a lot of like bad stuff in these antiseptic sprays and antibacterial things and antibiotics and these vaccines. It's like, it seems like maybe there's a lot of stuff in there that's not good. And so you kind of move into this, you know, holistic world. And then you're like, okay, so, you know, I need to boost my immune system and I need to eat really clean and I need to, you know, have all the filters and all the things in the house. And that, you know, again, that was my world for many years. And it was seeing people, you know, that's why it was such a breath of fresh air to come across the five biological laws, because there were moments where I was just really baffled because people that I looked up to, like mentors in my holistic health world, that did everything like so perfectly, right? They had all the, you know, the whole house water filter and every, you know, the showers were filtered and the food was clean and they just like lived such pristine, healthy lives. And then there'd be a diagnosis, you know, brain cancer, some other type of cancer, a heart attack. And it'd be like, what's going on? If these holistic measures were the be all end all bottom line. If you do these good, healthy things, you will not develop disease. Then, you know, the world stopped making sense to me in those moments when, you know, somebody that I thought was a picture of health, model of health, right? And how often do we hear stories? You know, we've got the 95-year-old uncle who smokes and, you know, eats fast food, eats food from the gas station, doesn't care about, you know, and has no like visible disease. Like there's nothing, you know, really wrong with him. And then we have the, you know, 45-year-old who is eating clean and juicing and detoxing and doing all of this stuff and just is struggling with a diagnosis. And GNM is the only thing that makes sense. It's the psyche. You could live the most pristine and healthy lifestyle, but that does not, you know, and while it does make you more robust, it does, you know, and that's where we are not throwing out all nutrition and healthy living and healthy lifestyle measures when you get in this world. It's not an all or none. It's a both and. We want to do, because eating things that are clean, eating things that, you know, are nourishing and close to nature, it feels good, right? It's better than, you know, eating fast food or a food from a box. That is, there's a different energy there, you know? So we want to be doing all those healthy things, but we also want to realize that it's the emotional, the psyche. If you have a shocking conflict, your body will adapt. Even if you've eaten the most healthy diet for the last 20 years, even if you have the most pristine as possible, you know, detoxed, clean environment, if you have a biological conflict shock that catches your psyche off guard, that was highly acute and dramatic, your tissues will adapt in the way that is appropriate for the circumstance 100% of the time, because it has to, because we're dealing with ancient biological programming that is based in survival. And so if you do have a specific type of shock, if you have a loss conflict, if you have a worry conflict, if you have an indigestible morsel or a death fright, right? Your body, your tissues will adapt as dictated by the ancient programming. That's just the way that it works. And so when you can understand that, you don't have to feel, you know, so many people feel as though, oh, my body has betrayed me, or I did all this stuff, I invested all of this into my health, and I still get, you know, cancer, or I still have this diagnosis, you know, and they feel, like you said, that sense of victimhood, this is happening to me. And that's the amazing thing about understanding the map, is that, you know, even if it doesn't make total sense to you, because you have a modern mind. We have to keep that in mind. It's sometimes hard for people to grok the map, because they're like, well, I don't understand. Why is it helpful for the body to build a tumor? Why is it helpful for the body to do this or that? It's like, because you're looking at it from a modern context instead of an ancient survival context. And it's Dr. Hammer gave us the full context to understand why what the body does actually makes perfect sense for the body to do it, you know, and it's our job to pay attention to what's going on. And that's where, you know, awareness is the core of like, what's going on with me, right? And is there, you know, am I feeling separated from a loved one? Why am I losing my hair? You know, like, oh, my hair, why do I keep losing hair? It's like, well, there's a separation conflict that's in the active phase, you know? And so, you know, you could eat all the good things, put all the rosemary oil on your hair, you know, eat, you know, all the nutritional supplements that are good for hair. But until you resolve this separation conflict, you know, you're going to keep losing hair. And so that's where understanding the biological conflict is so profound and helpful, because it kind of gives you, like, it directs you directly to the thing that needs to be addressed in your life, which is such a gift.
It is such a gift, really. I mean, that unlearning that the tumor, the cyst, the fibroid, whatever it is, the sty, unlearning that this thing is actually your body adapting as a response to the event, the emotional conflict, the shock, right? And now it's in this new phase. And now that you're aware of it, because for me, it was like, okay, well, this reoccurring thing kept happening to me before I understood GNM. I would get this lesion in the same exact spot every year, okay? The same time of year, almost to the date since childhood. It stopped for a while, but then it became active again after I gave birth. And once I understood GNM and I just became aware, right? I didn't really have a framework. I didn't work with you as a practitioner. I didn't actually know about you yet. And I remember saying, okay, well, let me look at the side where it's on. Let me look at the nature of it. Let me, kind of understand on a surface level what this could mean. And then I just, on my own, kind of reverse engineered the lesion and was like, oh, okay. And I just became aware of the potential conflict that happened when I was a child. It never came back again. I know that that's just one case where maybe there might be more work to be done in other situations, but just my awareness around the original event, the acknowledgement around the original event from, I think I was about 4, it never came back. So I don't know what I did, right? Except acknowledging the original root potential cause. And I can't be certain, no one's there on the other side saying, yes, Ayla, this is the event you found out. But myself, my higher self guided me to that specific event. I didn't need to really ask more questions. So there's a level of surrender and faith that does come with this framework of medicine, which is really hard for people to to also grok, I would say, because we are so used to having a practitioner or a doctor tell us to confirm, yes, this is the thing, I know that that's the model we come from, right? I know I have friends who say, well, I'm on this medication and I'm just waiting for the doctor to let me know when I can get off of it, because if I get off of it now, I could potentially have a flare up or whatever the case may be, And so we're still in that dynamic, many of us, where we're waiting for it to be told that it's okay to, do the thing. So the big one for me was understanding that cancer cells actually, they're an adaptation and the body is attempting to heal itself, because we grow up with so much programming, like cancer cells bad, cancer cells invade, cancer cells are here to get you, we're fighting cancer, right? There's so much languaging around it, rather than what I find with GNM, which is making an allegiance with the adaptation, the tumor, the cells, and, doing the work, because we want to get rid of it as soon as possible, because it feels like there's a time frame. We're on a time clock. And we've been told by the doctor, you're on a time clock. So there's a deep sense of urgency, and it almost feels impossible to acknowledge that cancer cells are actually just giving us information and that there's another option. What would you say to someone, of course this is complex, but what is that other option? What can one do? Right. And I know 3 people right now who are saying, I am completely opposed to conventional treatment and I would rather, just not do anything at all. But what to do conventional treatment, right? What can one do? What's the first step they might be able to take?
Yeah. And ideally we would have known this our whole lives. Like this wisdom, truly, it is like, learn it now, teach it to your children, so that the next generation can grow up with this. Because once a person, and that's the difficulty of when there is a diagnosis that has been given, right? Or when you even have self-diagnosed, let's say you haven't even gone into the doctor, but you feel something and you Google and you find and you're like, oh, I think it's this. As soon as you have, this fear, because we have been raised with, this is a bad thing, this is a wrong thing, there's something that's going wrong in your body and we have to get rid of it as soon as possible, that already, even if the doctor didn't give you a time clock, you've got that in your mind. And so, ideally this starts before we ever have a diagnosis. We learn, we know, we understand that the body is always constantly responding to our experience and that our tissues are always intelligently adapting to that experience. But so let's say you already have, something there. You want to seek to understand it. You really want to, learn the biological laws, understand the 5th biological law, that there is nothing meaningless in nature. Nothing happens for no reason. The body doesn't just spontaneously make something for no reason. It's not a mistake. It's not a wrongness. It's not a punishment. You're not being punished for something. Often, something like STDs, for example, are, people experience that, or even cancer. People can experience it as a punishment because we're used to this, consequences for your sins in the past. And here you are. This is, and it is because the body is simply adapting to what is needed, you know, and so it's not personal. It's not a punishment. It's not a wrongness. It is a logical change that these tissues, and think about it really, you know, so the person with the diagnosis or an area of your body that the tissues are doing something, right? The tissues here, something's happening with these tissues. Think about the why are those tissues there? What do those tissues do? If those tissues were given a signal that something needed to be adapted, right? We need to change this. It's like, you know, if the fire alarm, so if there's a fire in a building and all of the sprinklers are going off, all the sprinklers in the building are going off, it's like, okay, why is this going off? Why, what caused this to happen? Right? There was something that initiated this change in these tissues at this area. And yes, if sprinklers are going off in a building for a very, very long time, you know, it can be damaging to the building itself. Like that's one of the things, like a lot of times, again, people are like, okay, so the body is doing this, the body built this tumor, but now the tumor is blocking my ability to breathe, or it's blocking my ability to digest. And they say, well, how is that smart? Why is the body doing that? It's like, well, it's not, the body is doing the appropriate thing always, because it is programmed to do the appropriate thing. The problem lies in how long we were in the conflict, right? And so we can stay in conflict longer than we would have originally in nature, right? In nature, conflicts are really quick, right? It's a very swift, you know, we recently, you know, we have a little homestead and we recently lost our dear rooster, Sir Archibald. And we, you know, he just had disappeared one day. And then we, you know, we'd go find the pile of feathers. And, you know, like that was a pretty quick situation, right? The bobcat comes in, he tries to get one of the chickens, the rooster comes and defends the chickens. And, you know, he was in fight or flight. He was like, either I'm going to run away, but that he was a good rooster. So he didn't run away. He fought. He didn't prevail, right? But it was a short-lived thing. And so during that time, I'm sure his tissues adapted, right? So there was more oxygen getting in his lungs because he needed to fight, right? This was what his programming is, to fight this off. And so, you know, but it was a quick, you know, battle, and the bobcat prevailed and he got to have dinner, and, you know, we lost. That's nature, right? Fast. But we can have conflicts for years and years and years and put ourselves in unbiological situations and, you know, live with, you know, people who we really want to divorce or we really want to break up with, but we are stuck and we have all, you know, and we stay in less than ideal circumstances. So we have these ongoing conflicts that go on and on and on and on and on. And so there are some cases where a surgery, for example, might be the appropriate choice, given the length of time that the conflict went on, you know, but one way or the other, you still want to know the conflict, name it, like you said, define it. As soon as you like, you want to speak it. This is what it was. I felt, you know, I felt separated. I felt like you were tearing when you broke up with me or when you cheated on me, I felt like you were tearing my whole life away from me. Right. And so that's why the ductal breast cancer came, because it's a torn from my breast separation based conflict, you know, so define the conflict, speak about it, right? Because the elements of a conflict is it's highly acute, it's dramatic, it catches you off guard, you didn't expect it, and you felt totally isolated, like all alone in the universe, like you felt completely alone with it, right? And that's why the biology says we have to step in, we must adapt these tissues, because she can't handle this, right? She doesn't have the capacity, because not every upsetting event initiates a biological program. It has to meet the criteria. If it's not totally unexpected, but it is really intense, you know, it might not turn on a biological program for you. If it's really intense and it was unexpected, but you didn't feel totally isolated, you had support, you had someone to speak to about it. It's when we feel all of those things at once that the biological program activates, turns on, and the body is there to support us through it. And so when we can speak about it, when we can define it, when we can talk about it, just like your experience with this lesion, it's like once you kind of like brought it out of the subconscious, put words to it, say, oh, that is what I felt. I can understand why this would show up here and the things that were going on in my life. And as soon as your subconscious mind realized that what happened then at 4 or whenever can't happen now. And that's how kids grow out of things, or people kind of grow out of things, or, you know, it's like, yeah, that was an issue for me for years and years and years. And then, you know, I had kids or something changed in my life, or I left home, I moved away, and I haven't had that since. Well, it's because your psyche realized, you know, what happened then can't happen now. So it terminates the adaptation is no longer necessary. Right. And that's really, if a person's dealing with a chronic thing that's been going on, you know, for years and years, it's because it's still necessary. The adaptation is still necessary. That's why you're still struggling with the chronic constipation or the chronic skin issue or whatever. It's because you're still dealing with that conflict. And that's where either the situation has to change, right? You need to leave the situation, leave the job, change your environment, or you need to radically change you, right? The way that you're perceiving and experiencing the situation. Because when you become a different person, when your identity is no longer, you know, what it was and wrapped up in your job or your appearance or whatever, when you could laugh at that, the conflict is resolved. When it's like, it doesn't even feel like that happened to me, right? Those are the ways that, you know, because often people are like, well, how do you resolve the conflict? You have to change something out here or something in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, because there's also the very large group of people, or the belief system, let's say, that, well, my mother had this virus and that's why I have it too. It was passed down to me from birth, you know? And so people will say that, like, explain that, you know, with GNM. And I'm like, okay, you know? And so that's, you know, there's a whole other conversation to be had about quote viruses. However, I wonder, you know, we're getting into this, you know, realm of conception and birth and pregnancy and all of that. But how are these programs passed down through the mother? And how is that? Is it through belief system? Is it through the cells? Right? Because we can acknowledge genetics, but perhaps not in the way that it's, given to the mainstream. It's defined by the mainstream. How is it that something, a virus the mother had, is passed down to the baby?
It's all through experience. So, you know, from the moment of conception, you know, there's something happening there, right? And there's an experience and there's adaptation happening immediately, right? So depending on what the mother is experiencing, you know, all of that information is being passed down into the growing fetus, because it's information about the safety or danger of this environment. What do I need to do? A really cool story. So, you know, like when a child, say, for example, is born without a finger or with an extra finger, there's a story of a child that was born with two thumbs. And when the parents looked back at the gestation, okay, it's like, okay, this nature does what makes sense. Remember that fifth biological law. There's a way that this makes sense, that this adaptation, this is an adaptation to have an extra thumb. Why would the psyche have perceived the need for this? And so I think these parents, it was before they even knew that they were pregnant. And they were going skydiving. They were like people who like to go skydiving. And I think that there was turbulence in the plane, you know, as they were going up. And the mother was holding on, gripping for her life onto the seat in the plane, grip, 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 as hard as she can. It's like, okay, well, think about the message, right? When you think about practically, because the body only has this stuff to work with. Right. In order to help you, the body, the psyche can't, you know, the biology can't leave and like change the situation. It can't fix it. It can only adapt these tissues. This is what it's working with. And so if there was a message that says grip tighter, grip harder, our life, our mere existence, the survival of our lineage depends upon your ability to grip right now. Well, wouldn't that make sense? That something in the genetics, something in the expression, because what is it? It's just the genes are an expression, right? Whatever they are, do genes even exist, right?
Right, right.
Or, you know, but the whatever's happening there, right? The tissues are adapting to an experience, and there's an expression of something called two thumbs. Why would that be? Because it was necessary. Because the fetus got the message, it's so important for our survival that we are able to hold on. You know, another great story a woman shared with me recently is her grandmother had gigantism. And so the adenohypophysis and the pituitary. So there was like a tumor there. And so she had extra growth. And so when we look back at her experience, what happened when she was a child, her mother passed away when she was 8, and then the father stopped eating. And so he then too soon thereafter passed away. So she was orphaned and was sent to live with, some family member, and basically what was the message that her biology got? I need to be big. I need to grow up, right? I don't have anyone to take care of me. I need to grow up. I need to become bigger. And so, from the conventional theory, we think, oh, this is a genetic condition that she inherited from her, from her aunts, from her parents, and that's going to get passed down to her children. So I think she ended up having something like 10 kids. And then each of those 10 kids had 3 or 4 kids each. And the woman I was speaking to was one of these descendants. And so you would think somewhere along, these 10 kids and the 40 kids, all these kids that came from, that somebody would have this, right? Well, no, none of them, not one of them, because not one of them went through the experience of being orphaned at age 8 and needing to grow up and become really big, right? And so it's like, come on, it just makes so much sense. It's funny when you're like, yeah, that. When people hear it and when they really pay attention and when they see their own symptom through this lens, you can see that light bulb moment where they're just like, wow, yes, actually that does make perfect sense.
Well, sometimes it just feels so literal. And I reflect on how right now, and I don't know when, I feel that we had this knowledge before modern medicine. I know Dr. Hemmer brought this about, 70 years ago was when
1981.
He had been studying it though, right? He had been in the process of breaking this open, but before conventional medicine came into play, we had this knowledge. There was a deeper knowledge. I can't say exactly what it was, but we were more reliant on nature and our body's own healing process. Cross-culturally, there were so many ways in which this was true, right? But then when conventional medicine came along, it almost made healing and the cause is very esoteric and almost nebulous, where it's like, I have to have this degree in order to understand how these things interact so that I can then understand the cause and effect, and then I can figure out the cure. So it's like, no one can do that, right? Through that framework, we can't do that unless we go through this rigorous medical program, and so we now rely on people who have this right esoteric knowledge to give us the answers. And when we look at German New Medicine, it's like, it's really that straightforward. I really don't need to go through all of this and, whatever it is, go through, I would say, the gauntlet of getting to the right practitioner or even going through medical school to understand my own body. This isn't the way, So that's why sometimes I laugh out loud too when I'm, looking at case studies of German New Medicine and even hearing other people's stories. And I'm like, oh my God, if we could just pay more attention, even with certain children that I've worked with in postpartum as they get older, I sometimes go back and work in the home with the mother when she's had another baby, and I'm talking with the toddler and he or she's telling me things like, oh yeah, I can't see, sometimes I can't see out of this eye, or sometimes I can't hear this out of this ear, or sometimes I get, and I'm just thinking like, he or she's telling me that they're adapting, that they've adapted to something, and then I know the situation with the mother and the father. I understand a little bit of the inner workings of the family. I'm like, oh, the child is just adapting to actually a conflict that the mother and father are having, whatever that may be. And so children will tell us if we listen. But what I'm noticing is that so many of us are not listening. And like you said, we live with a conflict for so long because we are used to taking things like Motrin or Advil or whatever it is. We're so used to disassociating. We're so used to turning on the television or scrolling that we will suppress, what the signs are, or we put the child in front of the iPad, or we, enroll them in a bunch of sports and extracurricular activities so that we never get that opportunity for them to reveal to us the inner world, where the solution is there on how to release and relieve this conflict.
Yeah, the tissues are always speaking. It's like, okay, this, what does this mean? Like the skin. So a child with a rash, what is the skin? Think about, what is the skin? The skin is how we connect and communicate, and it's about touch. It's about closeness. It's about contact. And so if a child has rashy skin, what contact was either unwanted at that area or is wanted and missing? Wanted or unwanted. I either want touches here or I don't want touches here. And the rash is showing us the either absence of touch or the presence of unwanted touch. That's what it's showing us. Another really, this one's just so cool, especially, you know, for the pregnant mamas and in the birth world. This story is just so incredible. So this mother, you know, she had some questions about her son's, he was about 2.5. His testicles hadn't descended, you know, and so this was something that she was like, should I start being, you know, concerned about this? Should I start looking into this? You know, and she like would ask around, and you know, a lot of women are like, oh, well, my cousin or brother or whatever had to have a surgery, you know? And so then we started talking about it. It's like, okay, testicles, what? And let's get into the story. Let's talk about what happened during the pregnancy. Cause you asked, it's like, okay, so how did these things happen? Or, you know, these things that are passed down, or what happened during one, we want to look, you know, even at the conception, what were the circumstances of the conception? Was this wanted? Was this a surprise? Like, how did we respond to, you know, the knowledge that baby is on board? And then what happened during the gestation? Were there any shocks? Were there any things that caught you off guard? Any things that you had to, you know, experience or go through that was unexpected and, you know, isolating, and, you know, you kind of had a startle from it. And so one of the things for this particular mother was she had a daughter and a son, and this was baby number 3. And in her mind, she just expected, because she came from a family of all girls, she expected it to be a girl, you know, and she, you know, was excited for her daughter to have a sister and all of, you know, it was just something that she had kind of built up in her mind that, you know, she was fairly confident, you know, when the mama had just a feeling, I think it's going to be a girl. And then she finds out it's a boy. And so there was an unexpected, isolating kind of shock moment for her, where she was, you know, there was some, you know, some disappointment, you know, and this is not an uncommon thing. You know, people are human and you have expectations and you know, based on your own personal experiences. And so it's not like she did anything wrong or bad. She had a human experience, you know, but we have to realize that these human experiences, if there's messages being sent, right? And so the clearly the message that was sent is like, oh, my boyness is not fully embraced at this moment, right? It is not fully okay for me to be a boy. And so, you know, baby's born, they're so happy. They loved him, welcomed him fully into the family, you know, but still by 2.5, this, you know, something was still, you know, happening, active in his psyche. And so we talked about it. And so one of the recommendations for, you know, if there's a conflict with a young child, is to tell them the story while they're sleeping. Tell them your story, tell them the experience, tell them, like, be a real human and say, hey, you know what, when I was pregnant with you, you know, I expected, because I have sisters, I expected you to be a girl so that, you know, your older sister would have a sister, you know, but now I'm so excited and so glad that your brother has a brother, and you're so glad that you're a boy. And so we just kind of like talked about, like, what would be, you know, what would be a kind of a sigh of relief, or a, oh, it's really good to know that, you know, and because there's no perfect way to do this. It really is about, like, your heart, your intent. What would you want to communicate? If your child did get a message that it's not, you're upset or disappointed that I am the sex that I am, what would help you to be like, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, I understand why you've, and so we kind of talked through this potential, like, okay, yeah, give this a try. And 2 months later, we had another call, and she shares with me that, you know, she had done this. And within that 2 month period, not only did the testicles descend as normal, also his penis doubled in size, which she had also said that she, you know, had, you know, there were some concerns of, oh, is this, you know, is this normal? And so once this was embraced, once, you know, this story was told, his psyche got the message. It's okay for me to be a boy, you know? And so there, it's really just fascinating when you look at the body, right? The body is telling you the why. Okay, what is it? So it's holding on. There's not a full acceptance, a full expression. Why might that be? How could the psyche have gotten that message? And so we have to, you know, and it's really biological. This might sound a little woo-woo, a little out there to people, but when you just think about how profoundly logical it is for the biology to adapt based on the experiences that it has had, you stop thinking that this is like an out there weird thing, and you start saying, no, this is really logical that the body would respond in this way.
Of course. In the same way that when a lizard loses its tail, it grows back as a way to regain the balance and survive. I mean, it's just, we are wired to survive and we are wired to adapt. We're expert at it. I mean, even the mind will create scenarios and stories to maintain a sense of safety in unsafe situations and vice versa. So we are expert at that. I've had many clients over the years whose children are born jaundice, you know, when there's a yellowing of the eyes and the skin, and they often go into observation in the NICU for some time. They get UV light therapy, their additional blood work. I was actually born jaundice myself and spent some time. Now that I understand my conception story and, you know, what was going down with my parents at the time of the birth, I can understand why I was born jaundiced. It had nothing to do with, you know, my liver actually, in the sense that most people might think. And so when women say my baby's jaundiced, you know, they call me and say, what do? Do I breastfeed more? And then I just ask them, like, what was going on in the labor? Because I do work with women in postpartum. I don't, you know, it's not just about attending births. And I'm like, who pissed you off? Where was a line crossed? Where, you know, and they'll say, well, there was this nurse and she came in and she woke me up and she started an IV without asking and she was, you know, so then I just don't, I'm not a GNM practitioner. I just know the little I know, I could just ask questions for women to reveal to themselves where the conflict is coming from. You know, and just processing and, you know, her sharing the story. And it's like within hours, maybe two or three breastfeeding sessions, the jaundice is gone in her baby. So that field she shares with the baby's psyche, right? Because the baby also got a message, which is why they're, you know, showing these signs or symptoms, right, of the jaundice diagnosis. You know, there, once she can relieve that, like you said, or she can process that, then the baby gets the message too. You know, so in your work, what have you seen with a lot of these birth complications, let's say? Because when I do birth processing, I really invite the woman to relieve the blame off of the medical staff she chose, you know, for the most part, and start to ask, what was going on? Where did I self-betray? Where did I put myself in certain situations that I maybe didn't really want, but I convinced myself I wanted? Or where did I agree to an intervention that I didn't really want, but I did it because I didn't want to displease the doctor, or I didn't want to displease my family, right? So we look at it from that angle. But what are some of the interventions that you've, or let's say, symptoms you've seen come from certain decisions made in birth or in pregnancy?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's such a fraught time, you know, for potential split energy, right? Where it's like and especially depending on the choices, right? Like that you made and, you know, like, oh, I did what I was most comfortable for my husband or for my parents or, you know, and maybe it wasn't the thing that you really wanted to do. Maybe you were forced to, you know, a dear friend of mine is a doula, and she shares with me these stories of just how, oh, I mean, how predictably terrible the cascade of interventions goes. It really is. It's like, if you aren't aware of, you know, the impact of conflict and the predictability of what happens when you induce and when you kind of start, you know, you go down this road of this pressure, this time, as soon as a woman has time pressure, right? Oh, we can't go too early. We can't go too late. And we have to go right at this time. I mean, she's sharing with me stories of women who are being told to hold the baby in because the doctor is not here. Hold the baby in, right? And so that, think about the message that can be sent. I'm stuck. Like, I can't come out. And so that can, so a stuckness conflict can lead to motor delays, you know, because when the baby has this, like this freeze response where it's like, no, what's happening? You need to freeze. You need to stop your progression outward because the doctor is not here, which just absolutely boggles my mind.
I've had women say, like, I, like, in tears, like, I, the baby was right there and I really needed to push and I did everything I could. Like, I burst blood vessels in my face trying to hold the baby in. And I'm like, wow, this limited permission, as if you can't just birth because this one person who you don't even know really is not there in the room. You know, that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, wow, the stuckness conflict.
Feeling stuck, territorial anger, that is the bile ducts and the jaundice. It's like, I feel there's this threat. I am pissed. You're crossing my boundaries. This isn't, you know, so yes, is the baby that's coming out into the world is having a full experience. And often people do, they're like, well, you know, how could the baby, how could the child, you know, I recently, you know, kind of reshared and reminded everyone, hey, it's not viruses and bacteria that cause sickness. It's not an like a tiny little microscopic thing that comes and causes you to be ill. And that's so hard for a lot of people to grasp, because they're like, well, how then did my baby get sick? Because they assume, you know, again, it's kind of like, once you know like a little bit about it, you assume, oh, the baby has to have a conscious thought in order to have a symptom. And since the baby's not having conscious thoughts, of course it can't have symptoms. It's not about conscious thought. It's pre-conscious. The biological conflict is pre-conscious. It happens and your psyche perceives this at lightning speed. You know, before your conscious mind has even caught up to what happened, your biology was on the case and is adapted before you have words to describe how you felt about the situation. We can use the words and the thoughts after the fact to pull the thread to figure out what it was that happened. But we know just by the symptom what happened. If a baby has a stuffy nose, baby had a stink conflict, you know, and it's not that the baby said, oh, it stinks that my mother handed me to my grandmother for too long. And I, you know, the baby's not having a conscious thought. It's having an experience of, I can't smell my mother. I can't smell this, you know, and so that it registers in the psyche as a stink conflict, right? As a threat. And especially if mom, because someone, you know, was like, well, how then did my baby get a, you know, have a cold after grandma had a cold and grandma was holding baby and then baby got a cold. So the, you know, the conventional mind says, well, grandma had a germ in her nose and that's why she was stuffed up. And so she was holding baby, germ jumped onto baby, now baby's stuffed up. And that's how we just leave it there. But we're not thinking about the complexity of baby's experience. We're not thinking about the complexity of mom's experience giving baby to grandma, knowing grandma has a cold, and the fear, right, that is just embedded in this environment, because pretty much everyone believes in contagion. We and so there are these subconscious impressions that most people we just receive. It's kind of like it's the thought of society is impressed upon us. So even if you're like, oh, well, I'm not that afraid of germs. Even we were raised in a society that is. Therefore, there's a part of you, like a deep down subterranean part that you may not be consciously in touch with, that kind of still is afraid of germs, kind of thinks that, you know, this whole, you know, germ theory is you're more invested, right? Like the deep down part believes more in the threat of germs than in the knowing that bacteria come during the healing phase. The thing we call viruses are just simply protein particles that are present at the site of an adaptation zone of the body. And so, but this is, you know, this is where there's layers to it, right? It's nuanced, it's deep. It's like, you have to think there's multiple steps of thinking. The bacteria is very simple. It's like, oh, bug on body makes sick. Okay. We understand that makes sense. But like understanding that there is an experience, an adaptation, tissue changes, and then bacteria or, you know, microscopic things that occur during the healing phase. It's like, that's too many steps for kind of the, and that's why the germ theory is such a popular theory. It's because it's kind of easy to grok. It's like, okay, I get that. It makes sense to me. Don't sneeze on me. You know, wear the mask.
I know what steps to take. It's like easy marching orders. I'm still working through the lice issue. I know about pests, you know, and you know, so that's my subterranean piece that like is, you know, so yeah, we're not all exempt, right? Pun intended, but it's like we, you know, we all have those subterranean layers of belief to work through. And you know, you brought this up with the germs, right? Because when women are pregnant, they get the strep B test, the GBS test done. And it's funny because I have clients in all different countries and, you know, some of them will write to me and say, oh, I went to see my doctor today. And I said, oh, did they do any testing? And she's like, well, I asked about the GBS test that they do in the US. And my doctor was like, what is that? You know, like what, like we don't do, why would we do that? And then, you know, it's always like, well, if we don't test for it, does it exist, right? And so it's funny to me because in the U.S., doctors, midwives, midwives, meaning very medicalized midwives, and even nurses, right, will say you need to do the GBS test because, you know, if you're, quote, positive, right, the wording is also interesting, the language, if you're positive and you don't take 4 rounds of penicillin in your labor, your baby has the very high risk of being born with complications that lead to meningitis, and their brain could swell and they could die. And so then women are agreeing, like they get a quote unquote GBS positive diagnosis, and then they agree to take 4 rounds of penicillin in their labor. And we, you know, we all know, well, hopefully, what that level of antibiotic can do to not only the mother, the placenta, and the baby, but just the whole ecosystem in general. And so it's fascinating to me because there, you know, there are so many other things that can cause, right, that swelling of the brain that are completely unrelated to this quote unquote bacteria that women are being, you know, cornered into believing. What are, for the women listening, because I know this was a big question from my membership, like, so many of the doulas I train say, like, what can I say in that moment? Like, what resources can I offer? Because they know, but it's like, how can you explain that, right? Because there are women who say, yeah, but I did know someone whose baby did have brain swelling. And so then my doulas ask, well, were they, you know, jabbed with the Hep B vaccine? Were they separated from the mother for an extended period of time? Were, you know, they ask all these other questions. And of course, people are like, yeah, they were. Yeah, they did. Yes, they were circumcised, right? There's so many other very violent things done. And I say violent because non-consensual acts are always violent. And so the baby is not consenting to any of this. So yes, it's violent. And so these, you know, violent acts are happening, and then it can lead to these reactions, right? Full body rashes, brain swelling, vomiting, refusal, protesting to even breastfeed. There's a lot of things that can happen, but we want to say it's because she chose not to do antibiotics and had a GBS positive diagnosis, right? So yeah, I guess really my question here is, what is that quote unquote meningitis? You know, where does that come from in a newborn baby if not being positive with strep B bacteria?
So conventional medicine, of course, thinks that meningitis, all of these infections, this idea that a bacteria that was in the mother got onto the baby and now is creating this cascade of inflammation and problem and disease in the child's body. But that is not the case. We have to look at the experiences. And so this thing that they call meningitis, really, there's a lot of different things that it could be that is getting labeled as meningitis. We look at all healing phases have swelling in the brain. And if the area of the conflict was in the cerebral cortex, those zones in the brain, when that comes into healing and there is edema, so edema swelling, this can put pressure on the meninges. This can be the thing that they're labeling meningitis. And so, you know, if there was a scare fright, right, a speechlessness because of these cold hands or getting, you know, forcibly taken out of your mother's womb, or if there was a territorial fear, if there was a, you know, some type of frontal fear of heading into danger, all of these things can be conflicts that affect the area of the cerebral cortex, which when it comes into healing, there is edema, and that edema could get diagnosed as meningitis. Another thing could be a conflict of the skull bones themselves. And so this would be an intellectual self-devaluation And so often people will say, well, how could an infant baby have an intellectual self-devaluation? But a feeling of there's something wrong with me at a certain area of my body. For example, the head. So if the doctors or the nurses are saying, oh, the baby's head is too big, or it can't come out because of this. When we hear things that there's something wrong with my head, there's something wrong with my skull, when that experience is internalized by the biology as there's something wrong with me here, which can cause an adaptation in the bone tissue. And so, and as far as the different specifics of, again, when we're talking about this label of meningitis, there are a lot of different things that can be labeled under that umbrella. So could have flu-like symptoms, pneumonia, stiffness, paralysis. If there's seizures, then we're looking at a motor conflict or, stiffness. Again, feeling stuck. Did the baby at any point feel stuck in the birth canal? And so these are all things that we would have to take into consideration. Also, again, with this label of meningitis, it is a misnomer. The way that we're saying, oh, there's an infection, this itis. They see this as an inflammation of an infection of bacteria getting into the body. One, we have to also take into account, were there vaccinations? Were there any injections given to the child? Is there a poisoning that has gone on? And so that is something that we do take into consideration, if it's not a conflict, if it wasn't a conflict experienced by the child, but an injection. And we can also have conflicts when we receive injections, being held down, being separated from our mother can be a territory fear or a scare fright. And so those are just some of the things that could be under the umbrella of the label of meningitis.
Yeah, the whole story. I mean, one of the most common stories right now with women, because induction is chemical, artificial induction is so wildly popular, especially in the United States and Western Europe, for many reasons, right? A woman is showing some symptoms of preeclampsia. Maybe her blood pressure is high. There's a little bit of protein in the urine, or a woman's baby is measuring big in an ultrasound, and so they need to get the baby out before it's too big to be born vaginally, right? There's so many. And it's interesting. I mean, I've had many clients over the years who, go to get their blood pressure checked at whatever medical provider's office they're working with, and their blood pressure is high. And as soon as they get home, the blood pressure is low. And then, they are like, I don't, I'm being told I'm preeclamptic, but I don't resonate with the other symptoms. And now they're noticing that there is some swelling in their feet. And so they're saying, am I preeclamptic? Right. So it's almost like it's put into the consciousness. And then it's really hard to unlearn that. But what is, when a woman is actually showing those quote unquote signs of preeclampsia, that just comes out of, let's say, nowhere, right? Which we know is not true because nature doesn't make mistakes and everything's on purpose. What is that coming from? I know maybe that's a whole other conversation to be had, but generally speaking, what is preeclampsia?
Yeah, so protein in the urine is that kidney collecting tubule conflict I mentioned. So isolation, abandonment, refugee. My friend who's a doula, she's a doula in Los Angeles. And right now, a lot of people are refugees from their home. They can't go home. They maybe lost their home. So it's like when you hold on to water, the kidneys build up. They proliferate extra tissue to hold on to water. And then during the healing phase, that tissue breaks down. And so, if we've got protein in the urine, we're going through this kidney collecting tubule conflict, which, again, when a woman is close to giving birth, right, is she feeling totally comfortable? Is she feeling totally, financially secure? Is she feeling, like my nest is ready and prepared? Or are there fears? If the blood pressure is spiking high, we have to look at, is she feeling overwhelmed? Is there like a lot on her plate? Is even the idea of birth, giving birth, is that overwhelming to her? Or it could be a fluid conflict. That's another reason for blood pressure to spike. And so again, are we, hyperfixated on monitoring the fluids? Is it too much fluid? Is it not enough fluid? Right? So a fluid conflict affects the kidneys, and that can cause, the blood pressure to go up. And so again, what's this particular woman's story? Where was she caught off guard? How is she feeling unsafe? What, is her, and whenever you have like a looping thought, whenever you're in your mind kind of like arguing with yourself or kind of like going back and forth about, you need to look at that because that is an indication of a conflict. When the mind is compulsively thinking about, well, are we going to do this? Are we going to do this? Well, should I do this or should I do this? Bring that to the forefront Because that is, these compulsive thoughts are, you know, the psyche's trying to find a resolution to this conflict. And so that's one of the easiest ways, is paying attention to the thoughts that you're having, because that's going to show you what the nature of this conflict is. And so, yes, preeclampsia always makes sense, or the symptoms that they label with this name is simply adaptation in response to your experience. And, but again, it's such a pernicious label to put on, because then they, you know, they get you worried more about your birth. If we don't this, then that. If the blood pressure doesn't come down, then we're going to need to induce, and then we're going to need to, you know, get baby out early because we have to save baby. And so is that going to increase overwhelm or decrease overwhelm? Is that going to increase your existence conflict or decrease? It's like, and so everything that's done, you know, even as soon as you're in that world, you know, and you look things up and you're just like, and then again, we want to err on the side of caution, and we want to, because we, you know, the most important thing is that, you know, we have a healthy baby. And so we kind of don't listen to maybe our intuition, and we kind of go along with the thought of the day, right? Rather than truly listening to ourselves. And so, you know, and in that moment, it's kind of like, again, we want to kind of plan this before we ever even get pregnant. We want to know this before, because once you're in that situation, you know, you have this, the mother, you know, experiences this heightened sense of responsibility of like, well, I can't take a risk, right? And it feels, even though, again, it brings me more peace to stop going to these appointments and to, you know, to not get these labels even put on me. But, you know, and so that's the inner war, you know, it's like, can I trust myself? Can I trust my body? You know, but if something goes wrong, then I'll, you know, it's really, I mean, the birth world is just fraught with potential conflict, which is why, you know, again, ideally the woman understands and knows this before she conceives, so that she's not in this position where, you know, it feels risky to her to do what, you know, is most aligned, right? That, like, we want that to feel, oh, like this, it's the path of most peace. Really, you really have to go with what is the path of most peace. And, you know, there are situations where the person, you know, is more set at ease by being in a hospital setting, even though, you know, there can be some inner division. And so that's why we want to, you know, understand, learn these things, understand, you know, the position that we can be put in, and have this kind of pre-prepared, right? What would I do in this situation? And really trusting your instincts and intuition.
It's so spot on, because even the women I work with who have transfers from home birth to hospital birth, you know, when we reverse engineer that transfer, very often it does reveal itself that she, on a very deep level, did feel safer being in the hospital. So it was like the top layer was like, I don't want to be at the hospital controlled. And then underneath that, it was like, I want a home birth. But then underneath that, it was like, I don't really actually believe that the home birth is safe and the most, you know, easeful place for me to be. So then somehow they get back, you know, so exploring, you know, that honesty has to be there, and that self-reflection, the accountability, it has to be there. But that's part of the initiation into motherhood anyway, you know, so that's why I say there are no mistakes in the unfolding of the birth. And, you know, with newborns, they have their own initiation as well. There are these biological steps that are taken, one of which is passing through the canal, right? Without being told to stay in. But, you know, that sense of fighting for your life, right? Coming out, fighting for your life without a vacuum, without forceps, without a C-section, actually passing through the vaginal canal, getting out and taking that first breath without being forced to take the first breath. And what is being forced? The clamping of the cord, which stops the oxygen supply and forces the baby to use lungs in an artificial way. And so what I have seen, you know, if we look at the, you know, I'm not really following this closely as you know, these cases, but I have seen over the last decade that children born by a C-section do have a different constitution, you know, different challenges as far as completion with things in life. They didn't go through those initial steps of having to fight or saying, I'm ready to come out, because C-sections are very often done before the child has initiated, has released urine and protein into the mother's system when it's ready to be born, right? All those signals were not popped off. And so the baby was basically evicted before it was ready. And so I'm starting, you know, personally to notice many differences in the constitution, let's say, or the belief systems that a lot of individuals hold about their purpose and place on earth based on how they were born and the interventions done at the time of their birth. So there are these really essential, beautiful biological steps that we want to encourage women to allow their baby to take at that moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's patterns, you know, so like, just like in nature, patterns repeat themselves. There's like really cool observations of, you know, people that, you know, work with the biological laws, but also kind of look at, you know, patterns in people's lives. And they have found that how you come into this world, it's like kind of how you start new things, right? Do you have to, you know, be forced to start new things? Or, you know, does it have to be on someone else's timetable? It's like, you know, because again, the psyche, like your whole system has gone through a certain pattern, and patterns tend to repeat themselves. That's why this whole thing, like every year, this lesion or whatever would appear. It's because there's a timetable, there's a pattern that that your system has gone through. And it's like, oh, this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. In recall healing, they call it the project purpose, which is basically, it's the 9 months before you were conceived, your conception itself, the nine, you know, or so months of your gestation, and then your first year of life constitutes your project purpose and your basically the patterns that you'll go through, right? And so like, what happened to your parents, you know, before you were conceived? Oh, they broke up, and then they, you know, had to move. It's like, you'll often have, you'll mirror these patterns in your life. And it's really cool to pay attention and to look back at, when do things happen to me, right? It's like, oh, it's, you know, and when did you leave the house? When did you, you know, kind of individuate from your parents? And all of these things will tend to be repeated in your life again and again. And it's through awareness and acknowledgement of the pattern of seeing, oh, have I learned this lesson yet? Have I kind of gotten the message, the thing I needed to learn from this? Or is this pattern going to come up again and again and again? And often, you know, with greater amplitude each time it comes up to be, you know, to be learned. And it's like, oh, isn't this interesting? Whether it's a car accident, you know, all of these things have such deep meaning. And it's really cool to observe that and just take it into consideration, you know, and even ancestrally and what, you know, the things that your parents and their parents went through, it does have an influence on how you're predisposed to see the world. Of course, it's going to have an influence on how you're predisposed to see the world, because it just makes biological sense that you would be, that you would have, you know, you'd be more, you know, if a family, you know, went through bankruptcy, you know, like the finances, like money's going to be something that is of greater importance to someone who's had some type of major loss than somebody who's not. And so these things are all very cool and interesting to pay attention to my unique circumstances, right? Where has this come up before? You know, is this even the first time? Because often, you know, the conflicts and things that you're dealing with today were rooted in very, very early life experiences. Even, you know, so a person who was unwanted during their pregnancy, right? They often will have this like sense of, I don't belong here. I don't belong anywhere. I don't feel like I, you know, like, why am I even existing?
Yes. When the mother's contemplated abortion throughout her pregnancy due to the nature of the conception, for sure.
Yeah. And so it's like, oh, this is, you know, there's a situation here. I worked with someone who, she said that she was conceived by her parents when the mother wasn't really into it that particular day. And she was also on her period. And she said that she and her mother conceived, you know, regardless. And she said that she always, you know, when she starts new things, she feels like she's kind of working through the mud. I was like, isn't that interesting way to describe it? Working through the mud. Like, I feel like I have to kind of prevail through the mud. And I'm like, come on, that is, you know, very fascinating.
Absolutely. I mean, the egg is having its experience as it's traveling to its fertilization, you know, and we don't consider that. It's like, I mean, we're very much so in a world where women think, you know, because it's just how we've been taught, you know, just think about what supplements can I add to my routine and what things can I avoid during pregnancy? And, you know, let's just see what happens. Right. But there's a whole world of considerations, you know, and that takes us into the interesting realm of IVF and, you know, artificial conception surrogacy. You know, that surrogacy is a huge topic for me in particular. Not a lot of people in the birth world really want to talk about it, for fear of, you know, hurting anyone's feelings or offending anyone. But there are major repercussions to consider when it comes to, you know, it's funny, I look at the advertisements for surrogacy pages, websites, you know, to try to sell surrogacy or to encourage women to come and be surrogates. And there's these banners that flash that say, you have no biological connection to this child, right? Don't worry. This is not your child. It's an easy way to make extra money and help a family in need. You know, the biological parents are the ones donating the sperm and the egg. And I'm like, are we missing the huge fact, right? If we're just going to go on facts that are published, are we missing the huge fact that, you know, a baby's cerebral spinal fluid is formed by the gestating mother's amniotic fluid? So how can you tell me that there's no biological connection, right? So when we get into that realm, it's really fascinating to acknowledge that there are, you know, there's an entire universe, let's say, that impacts that child's life based on all of these interesting scientific interventions.
Yeah, and it just, you know, a lot of it is like, does this make sense in nature? Would this happen in nature? And, you know, when it comes to these highly technologically advanced techniques that we do to try to, you know, it's like, well, that wouldn't really happen in nature. You know, you would never, like, the surrogacy, that doesn't happen. You know, if a baby happens to, so like, we have this little cow that was taken from her mother at like 7 days old, or even before that. And, you know, and so, you know, these little cows, they struggle, these little bottle calves, because I'm like, this is completely unnatural, you know, for you to be separated from your mother. You know, it's like, it's not right that this happened. I'm sorry that this happened to you. You know, that is, you know, when children are, you know, taken away, you know, a surrogate, it's like, okay, here, you're done here. And when you're given to a person who doesn't smell, it's like, it's very primal, right? Like, you don't smell like what I would expect you to smell like, right? Like where I was formed and where I was gestated, it really is. And, you know, doing what makes sense, right? Doing what makes sense in nature, you know, a lot of times, and big picture, you know, can these situations turn out for the best? Of course, you know, and it's like, but on the front end, if we're trying to, you know, live in alignment with nature and do what makes, you know, biological sense and what's best for, you know, the baby. And of course, like you can grow through obstacles and you can, you know, grow through struggles but, you know, people who are separated from their birth parents, there's kind of like, unless great care was taken to help that child to adjust to the new environment, there is always this kind of like, I don't feel okay in the world, right? Because I don't have that solid foundation of, you know, connection with mother. And even children that are given to their birth, that are with their birth mothers, often don't have that connection, because, you know, we have these little machines that, have you seen those like little bouncers that hold the bottle for you so that like, you don't even need to touch the child. So there's, you know, there's so much disconnection and there's so much, you know, outsourcing of the mothering rather than that skin on skin, you know, baby's basically with you 24/7 for the first, you know, 2-3 years of life. That's that firm foundation. And to live biologically does mean to forsake modernity in many senses, is to say, oh, should I really go back to, I was speaking with a mother this week and, you know, she's telling me about a situation with her child and something that happened, or like her choice to start working at 6 weeks. And then later on in the story, we start talking about her and she's like, yeah, you know, my mother went back to work at 6 weeks. And I was like, and she hadn't made that connection until I was like, well, isn't that interesting that you chose to go back to work, you know, when your baby was 6 weeks and your mother, and how, you know, it's all this looking at the mirror, looking at, ooh, why did I make these choices? And it's not to condemn, and it's not about guilt or shame. It's not about feeling bad or feeling like, oh, I've made these terrible mistakes. None of this should bring a sense of condemnation. It should all bring a sense of wonder and interest, right? Like, oh, isn't that interesting? Ooh, if I, you know, it makes more sense to do it this way than that way. But if there's a big sense of guilt, or if you like hear or come across G&M concepts and you start feeling scared or bad, you want to look at the mental process by which you're coming to that bad feeling, because it's not the information, you know, it's how you're processing it. And if you tend to process things through the lens of shame and guilt and feeling bad rather than, ooh, this is interesting. What can I learn from this? How can I grow from this? How can this improve my life experience? You know, it's a very important piece of learning anything, is how do I engage with the information? Because sometimes people will like hear something and they'll automatically go to bad feelings rather than, you know, if you continue to learn it and you continue just to see, oh, you know, I would like to, this would be a more ideal way to live, but we can't always live in ideal circumstances. So given that this has happened, how do we, again, it's the whole story is adaptation. The whole story is adaptation and evolution and becoming, you know, going through something maybe that was less than ideal and growing from it, learning from it, right? That's how we develop wisdom. That's how we develop, you know, ways of doing things that are, you know, better than they were before.
Absolutely. And, you know, I could talk about this for hours, honestly, because I just feel like it's this incredible maze. But, you know, there's so many of us, and even people I've worked with, that say, why do I need to relive the trauma, right? Because I ask questions like, what could have been happening then? Why would, you know, I don't want to go back to that. Why do I need to relive that in order to heal? And I wouldn't say it's about reliving. It's more of an acknowledgement, and it can feel super painful, right? Because we've adapted, you know, to maybe sometimes not even feel that pain anymore, you know, and so we've found a comfortable way of living, even if it means having a chronic illness, even if it means having this pain in one part of the body, you know, and having to take a daily pill. It's better than acknowledging what was and allowing it to breathe and be and essentially to archive in a way, you know? And so when we're not ready to do it, we're not ready to do it, right? But would you say this is a matter of having to relive trauma, or it's simply an acknowledgement?
It's an acknowledgement. It's like I'm on my computer, and here, if I have a folder and it's like I've minimized the tab, right? So I'm not looking at it, but it's still taking up RAM, right? On my hard drive. There's still energy that's being put towards it. And so again, these things that are unconscious, it's like, okay, let me click open this folder. And it's like, do I actually need this anymore? Right? It's like, sometimes you have to look at it in order to determine whether or not, do I need this anymore? Right? And sometimes it is, as soon as you look at it, like your, you know, example you gave with the lesion, when you looked at it, right? Like something turned off because it, you know, some part of the psyche was like, oh, we don't need this anymore. Right? That's the purpose of the looking. It's not to relive it. It's not because, you know, it's like, I need to bring what's in the subconscious, what's in the unseen, right? What's in the minimized folder. Let me open the folder and see, do I still need this file? Do I still need to be running this program on my computer? Is this still necessary? Right? And so if it's not, if you're like, oh gosh, I don't even need this anymore. This is completely based on my life now. This is not even relevant. You know, sometimes that can happen without your conscious engagement, right? And so again, that's how you kind of grow out of things. It's just not relevant. And so the brain computer just self terminates that program. It's like, okay, that's not necessary. But sometimes if something's been kind of there for a while, you need to look at it. You need to open the folder. You need to see what is on this. Ooh, you're like, ah, well, that could happen again. That's still kind of relevant, right? I might actually need this particular program. And so, okay, now is this something that is changeable? Can I change the situation? Can I change my perspective of it? What would make this no longer necessary? It's very helpful to kind of think about it in those terms, because even like, you know, everything's a mirror, like even the way that they program technology and computers, what is that modeling? What is that mirroring? The human brain, right? The human supercomputer. And so it's like, let me open this folder. Let me see what's relevant, what's not relevant. looking at it is basically to clear what's no longer needed. Don't need that file. Don't need that one. This one can conclude. That's okay, right? And then there are certain conflicts that, you know, you might not want to resolve, and that they kind of say in that folder that's like, we're not going to touch that because, you know, it's kind of so deeply embedded, it might, you know, kind of cause the whole computer to destruct. And so there are certain things that you might not want to touch, but that's where, you know, the brain scan is very helpful for determining that. And then, you know, also just learning the map. When you understand the map and when you're like, okay, this conflict was way too early, went on for a really long time, you know, we're not going to touch that one. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, vastly improve your experience and kind of work around it, you know. And so everything can be worked with. We just want to do it in a, you know, consciously in a way that, you know, makes sense in terms of the biological laws.
Beautiful. And I know that so much of your work is bringing this knowledge to people to be able to take their experience back into their own hands and essentially disabuse them from that victim dynamic, right, with their environment. So I know you have a program. I don't know if it's running right now, but how can people initiate their journey into this?
Yeah. So I have there's a lot of different options. I am the course. This will be the second time that we're running it, called The Biological Woman. This one's just great for women who want to learn the GNM model for all of the feminine organs, right? How do the breasts adapt, the uterus, the cervix, all of the different tissues that the woman needs to know about. You know, there's a module in there where we talk about, you know, birth and pregnancy and conception and all of the things related to, you know, from menarche to menopause, like all the different biological programs that we can run. So that's opening again in early February. I also, you know, so there's another really cool dimension of my work that has come up in the last several months, which is working with animals, you know. And so the animals, just like children, they are mirrors, right? So like, that's where, oh, this thing is going on with my dog. What's happening with my dog? It's like, okay, well, we'll look at what's going on with the dog. And very soon we will need to turn the conversation to what is going on with you. And so, I have paired up with my colleague Amy, and she and I created a course called Animirror, which is understanding all the biological programs as it applies to animals. And then how is this a mirror for me? And we did an 8-week live class in the fall last year, and it was just the coolest thing, because people would come with stories about their bunny, their dog, you know, a pig at the farm sanctuary, and we could see the mirror, like what is being shown to me about my own inner experience. And, you know, being here on the homestead with all of these animals, I mean, it is just remarkable to see, you know, these, because like children, it's just this unconditional love, and they're just showing you, you know, yourself. And it's been really, really cool. So that's another way to get into this world. If you're like into animals and you want to, you know, or your pet has a particular thing, the Animirror class is a great option for checking out, you know, the world of GNM, but also that, what's going on with me? What is this showing me about me?
That's awesome. And people can still work with you one-on-one as a mm-hmm. patient. You have that availability. Awesome. Well, I'm going to share all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been such a pleasure for me. This information is something that resonates on some level for everyone, because we know this. We know this to be true. And so I look forward to the unraveling process, which is sometimes intense, but also very beautiful for people to experience. So thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you for having me. This is a super fun conversation.